Welcome to the Sports Law Biz Podcast, dedicated to helping people better understand the law and business of sports. I'm your host, Peter Ott, and we've got a lot to talk about here today, so why don't we just jump in? Hello, this is Peter Ott with the Sports Law Biz Podcast. I'm here today with Elliot Rosenberg, a 2013 graduate of the University of Southern California Gould School of Law and author of an article published in the spring 2015 edition of the Sports Lawyers Journal. We're here to discuss the topic of his article, which is entitled The NCAA's Transgender Student Athlete Policy, How Attempting to Be More Inclusive Has Led to Gender and Gender Identity Discrimination. It should be an interesting discussion. So to start off, Mr. Rosenberg, can you introduce yourself so that we can better get to know you?
Sure. And thank you, Peter, for having me on your podcast. My name is Elliot Rosenberg. I originally from New York, always knew that I wanted to go into the world of sports from a young age. And when I was in college studying sports business on the East Coast, I really kind of enjoyed studying the intersection between sexual orientation, gender identity, and the world of sports. So after college, getting my master's degree in sports management, I headed out to the West Coast to the University of Southern California and studied law at the University of Southern California and became a commercial contracts attorney. And that's what I do now. I'm a commercial contracts attorney for a large publicly traded company. And in my role, part of my job is to oversee the sports department. And so I handle sponsorship agreements and various sports related contracts.
Okay. Well, great. Sounds like you got an in into the sports world pretty early on in your career. So that's good for you. Well, if we move on, we can talk about your article today. Like I said, it was published in the spring 2015 edition of the Sports Lawyers Journal. Again, the title is The NCAA's Transgender Student Athlete Policy, How Attempting to Be More Inclusive Has Led to Gender and Gender Identity Discrimination. So let's start this off at a basic level. Can you just provide us with an introduction and background for your article?
Sure. So the article is about the NCAA's policy, which, you know, we'll go into more detail as we go along today. But the policy as it relates to the participation of transgender student athletes in NCAA sports. And, you know, the article goes through a number of things about the policy and, you know, determines that the policy actually ends up discriminating against a certain subset of people, even though the policy's intent is to be more inclusive.
Okay, so it's a good intent by the NCAA. The implementation is problematic.
Exactly.
Okay, so again, just starting off from a basic level, you know, a lot of people listen to this podcast. You know, you talked about an interest in intersectionality between gender and sports and things like that. I think some of the people listening to this are not even aware of any intersectionality. So let's just start at a basic level. Can you explain, you know, what the term transgender means?
Sure. So the word transgender can be defined in a few different ways, but for the purposes of my article and the purposes of the discussion today, I'm going to use a definition from the National Center for Transgender Equality. They define the word transgender as an umbrella term for people whose gender identity, expression, or behavior is different from those typically associated with their assigned sex at birth. So on a basic level, that kind of boils down to someone whose own identity, who they believe they are, is different than the sex that was assigned to them by the doctor who was there to oversee their birth.
Okay. And so people who identify as transgender experience problems throughout their lives, both in and out the sports world. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah. There's a lot of different areas where a transgender person can face discrimination in everyday life, from, you know, housing discrimination to employment discrimination, you know, you name it. And there's an area in a person's daily life where they can be discriminated against based on their gender identity.
Okay, and can you give some examples of how that happens? Is it just general, you know, animosity, violence against transgender people? Is it legal problems, or is it all these different kinds of things?
Yeah, it's all of the above. There have been many instances of violence against the transgender community, you know, hate crimes against transgender individuals, from, you know, murders on the street to transgender individuals being beat up. you know, in the legal sense, there are a number of situations. I think I mentioned employment discrimination, people getting fired from their jobs because of their gender identity, housing discrimination, people not renting or leasing spaces to transgender individuals just because of their gender identity. There have been a number of instances where transgender people have been discriminated against by law enforcement officials because of their gender identity. In the prison system, you can be discriminated against because of your transgender identity. That's a theme of the popular Netflix show Orange is the New Black right now.
Thanks for providing that. I think when you hear the word discrimination, I think a lot of people think, oh, that means, you know, what you think of as a typical hate crime, somebody committing violent acts or something like that, and then that happens every day in America. But, you know, also I think it's important to recognize just the way people speak, not even intending to hurt people, just speaking about appearance, you know, making little jokes and things like that. I've seen that in my life. Just people, the way we just talk and approach conversations can be, you know, If I was a transgender person, I would certainly feel uncomfortable with a lot of the conversations I've heard.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's also important to remember as we talk about transgender individuals is that not every person who is transgender wants to have surgery, wants to correct their appearances, or even the pronouns used when referring to that person. A lot of times people confuse the words transsexual and transgender. The word transsexual is used to define someone who specifically wants to undergo what is referred to as sexual reassignment surgery, or sometimes in the media called a sex change. That is a subset of transgender individuals, but not all transgender individuals want to go through that surgery, want to go through medical procedures, hormone treatments, or, you know, and some don't even change their physical appearance at all, and they live their life as a transgender individual, but they may believe that the sex or their gender is different than what was declared at their birth.
Okay, yeah, and that's important, I think, before we get into the NCAA stuff. That's part of where the problem comes from, right? Is some people think, oh, transgender means having had a sex change or taking hormones or something like that, and that's certainly a subset of the transgender population, but that is not the broader definition of transgender.
That's right.
Okay, well, great. Let's move into talking about the NCAA's policy with respect to transgender student-athletes. So what is that policy?
So the policy from the NCAA came down in August of 2011. And that was right around the time that Kaia Lums, who was a women's basketball player on the George Washington University women's basketball team, came out as transgender. The policy, which was approved by the NCAA's executive committee, states that a transgender male student athlete, so that is a person who is claimed by a doctor to be female at birth, who considers themselves male, that person who has received a medical exception for treatment with testosterone for their gender transition may compete on a men's team, but is no longer eligible to compete on a women's team without changing the status of that team to a mixed team. So a transgender male, someone who believes that they are male, but the doctor declared them a female at birth, basically can no longer play on a women's team as soon as they start taking hormone treatments, but can immediately start playing on a men's team. And that would have no effect on the team's eligibility for NCAA contests.
Okay, so is that the entire policy, or is it different with respect to transgender females?
So it is different with respect to transgender females. So for transgender females, someone who is born a male but believes that they are a female, those student athletes who are being treated with a testosterone suppression medication for gender transition may continue to compete on a men's team, but can no longer compete on a women's team without changing it to a mixed team status until they complete one calendar year of documented testosterone suppression treatment.
Okay, so that's different than the treatment of transgender males.
Right. So you can see that the difference between the treatment of transgender males and transgender females is that for a transgender female, so someone who believes that they are a woman, to compete on a woman's basketball team or a woman's soccer team, they have to complete a minimum of 1 year of hormone therapy before they're allowed to compete on that team without changing the team's status for NCAA purposes.
Okay, whereas a transgender male can switch to the other team without the 1 year of hormone treatment required.
Exactly.
Okay. And what are the NCAA's reasons for this transgender student athlete policy?
So I think the NCAA's reasons for this policy, and I actually had the opportunity to speak with the head of the NCAA's diversity and inclusion program at the NCAA. The reasons for this policy are all good. The NCAA had good intentions when they put this policy and approved this policy into place. The reason for the policy was that they wanted to create a policy that would allow transgender students to participate in NCAA sports and to kind of put forth a uniform policy so that different schools and different conferences within the NCAA didn't have different policies. And so the intention was good. You know, as you mentioned earlier, as we started this conversation, the issue is all within the execution of the policy and what was written. So one of the things that the NCAA wanted to eliminate or prevent by issuing this policy and allowing transgender student athletes to play in NCAA sports was they wanted to prevent this thing that they refer to as unfair competitive advantage. It's probably the worry that you hear of the most when governing bodies in the world of sports are determining policies for transgender athletes. Most governing bodies think that just because a person was born a male and now wants to compete on a women's basketball team, that that is going to give that person an unfair competitive advantage over the quote unquote real women that are playing in that sport. And there are a number of problems with that. The reason why people consider a person who was born a male to have an unfair competitive advantage when playing in women's sports is all based on the theory that men are superior to women, or that men have physical attributes that are greater than those of women that will give them an unfair competitive advantage in a sport. The problem with that argument is that, first of all, not every person that is born a male, not every male who is not transgender is going to be able to compete with women who are playing professional or even collegiate sports. You know, there are plenty of men out there who are born, you know, with a height of below 6 feet that would not be able to compete with the women who are currently playing women's basketball, Division I, Division II, or Division III women's basketball in the NCAA.
Yeah, that's definitely me. I can tell you that. I couldn't compete out there.
and neither could I. And I've tried. So, you know, the women who are playing NCAA D1 basketball, they're incredible. They are phenomenal athletes. They have practiced for years and years, and no person who is a male at birth who just walks onto a court is going to have a really easy time defending one of those women.
Yeah, but again, just going back to something I said earlier, I think, you know, in conversations that I've heard or had with people, I've heard people say that, oh, I could just step onto a court, you know, and you know, I'm bigger and stronger. I could beat any women's basketball player. And I, you know, I think that's a provably false conclusion, generally, for a lot of people.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I'm sure there are lots of women's basketball players that would help you prove the falsity of that conclusion.
Right.
You know, there are a couple other reasons why it's not a logically acceptable argument, this unfair competitive advantage argument. And one of the other main reasons for that is that we do not limit a player's ability to play a sport just because they have a competitive advantage over another player in the sport. We don't limit Michael Phelps's ability to compete in the Olympics or any swimming events just because he might have a greater lung capacity than some of his other competitors, and that enables him to swim faster. Within the world of women's sports as well, we've got a player who just graduated from Baylor University, Brittany Griner, who was an absolute superstar in the world of women's basketball. She was 6 foot 8 inches tall and just towered over the competition. But because Brittany was 6'8" tall, you know, nobody in the NCAA stopped her from competing in the sport because she was an average of 3 to 4 inches taller than every other center that played the game. And that's something that's important to note because, you know, a lot of people think that having a transgender woman playing in women's sports is going to not only give that woman a competitive advantage, but also may lead to more injuries in the sport. You know, people are sometimes concerned with the safety of the other women playing the sport. And that's just not a valid argument because, like I said, we don't stop people who are bigger and stronger, who were announced by the doctor to be a woman at birth. We don't limit their ability to play sports if they're 4 inches taller than the rest of the competition, whether that's on the collegiate level or the high school level or the middle school level.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting point, I think, because not only do we not stop people with competitive advantages from participating, you know, that's a large reason why we watch. You know, it's the Kevin Durants of the world who are taller than everybody and great shooters. And that's why, you know, people look up to him as one of the best basketball players, in part because of his work ethic and stuff like that, but in part because of innate physical characteristics that allow him to be one of the best basketball players in the world.
That's exactly right.
What about this idea that, again, a quote-unquote real man might pretend to be a woman to gain advantage? Is that a fear of the NCAA as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something that a lot of governing bodies cite, that fear that people are going to start posing as women in order to play women's sports, or women are going to start posing as men to play men's sports. And there are a number of problems with that reasoning, one of which is, you know, gender identity is a very serious thing. It's something that people struggle with for years of their lives because of the way society looks at it. And, you know, these are people who are struggling with their own personal identities. It's wrong to say that this is taken lightly by anyone, even someone who is attempting to pose as someone of the opposite sex. In addition, there have been no recent cases in any sports body, you know, at least on the professional level or collegiate level, where someone has attempted to join a team of the opposite sex by posing or falsifying their gender. It's not something that happens. It doesn't happen on the Olympic level. It doesn't happen in professional sports. And there aren't any recent cases, certainly, of it happening on the collegiate level, even with this policy being enacted for the last 4 years on the men's side.
Yeah, I think that's a fear that just is not a realistic fear. It's unrealistic to imagine that somebody would, you know, change their gender identity, such an important part of who they are, just to be able to play sports.
Right. And I think we also have to remember that the reason behind the argument here that people might change their gender to play sports is once again to gain a competitive advantage, which it was what we just talked about as being something that doesn't really work out as a logical argument because of what, quote unquote, gaining a competitive advantage means in the world of sports.
Right. Okay, well, let's move into some of the legal discussion about this policy. Again, there's a different treatment of transgender males and transgender females in the NCAA policy. Does this different treatment present a constitutional violation of equal protection or something like that?
You know what? That's a really great question. In many cases, especially within public schools on the, you know, in the middle school and high school level, it very well might present a constitutional violation. However, when we're talking about the NCAA, what's important to remember is that there was a very important Supreme Court case decided in 1988, the Tarkanian case, which found that the NCAA is not a state actor and was a private association. And therefore, the NCAA does not have to comply with all of the federal rules and regulations. And so the discrimination faced by most athletes within the NCAA is not actionable under the federal laws of the United States.
Well, yeah, no, that's an interesting legal point there. Okay, let's move on. Now, some people say, you know, the NCAA has many eligibility requirements for student athletes. I think anybody familiar with college sports knows all the different rules that college athletes have to comply with. So some people might ask, why is it improper for the NCAA to require someone to undergo hormone treatment for a specific amount of time as an additional eligibility requirement?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a great question. Like you mentioned, the NCAA has a ton of eligibility requirements, you know, from things like grades to SAT scores to maintaining grade point averages and various other eligibility requirements that athletes have to meet and maintain in order to play and continue to play in NCAA sports. It's really important to note, though, that this requirement for a transgender female to participate in women's sports really presents the first time where the NCAA is requiring medical treatment that can only be given by a doctor in order to be eligible to play a sport. And that's a very significant development and a very significant, I think, flaw in this policy.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's certainly a big requirement. It's invasive. There's some issues there.
Yeah, there's a lot of issues. I mean, we have to remember when we're talking about NCAA athletes, we're talking about people who range from the ages of about 17 to 22. You know, people who are teenagers when they start playing NCAA sports. You know, individuals who come into the NCAA and might not even be considered adults in the states that they live in. And, you know, it's really important to consider the consequences of requiring someone to go through hormone therapy in order to play sports. As we discussed before, the fact that many transgender people do not want to go through hormone treatment. There are transgender individuals who never want to go through hormone treatment, either because they don't want to do that to their body, they don't want to change their body, they're scared of going through that treatment. There's a cost to going through that treatment, both in time and financially. You know, there are a number of reasons why, and especially when we're talking about teenagers and people who might not be considered adults, you know, sometimes their parents might have to consent to undergoing this kind of treatment. And, you know, there are instances where parents might not be accepting of their transgender son or daughter and might have issues with that child going through treatment at such a young age.
Okay, yeah, no, so there's, I mean, financial, you know, health, mental issues, all kinds of reasons why that's problematic to have this special eligibility requirement.
Right.
Okay. Well, I guess that flows pretty well into kind of finishing up here. What recommendations do you have for the NCAA with respect to this policy?
You know, there are a couple recommendations that I have with respect to the policy. First and foremost, removing the hormone treatment requirement, I believe, is an important step that the NCAA needs to take in a policy that they themselves admit will likely evolve over time. The NCAA needs to remove any policy that is in their bylaws that requires student athletes to undergo medical treatments that they may or may not want to undergo in order to be eligible for sports. Every student, no matter their gender identity, sexual orientation, race or religion, you know, should be able to play NCAA sports. At the end of the day, the NCAA, you know, is there to help students grow through their participation in sports and help them develop professionally. And I think talking to a lot of NCAA players, sure, some of them are going to have their quips and their complaints about the NCAA and what their real purpose is. But I don't think you'll find many NCAA athletes that will tell you that sports has not in one way or another helped them evolve and grow as a person. And, you know, it's important that we allow everyone who wants to grow and evolve as a person and who wants to play sports at the collegiate level to have the ability to participate. And that should be done without requiring them to undergo any sort of medical treatment. The second thing that I would say to the NCAA is that any requirement, anything that they are going to ask a transgender student athlete to do in order to either prove their gender or prove their gender identity or anything which they might require of a transgender student that's different from a non-transgender transgender student, they should pay for. You know, like we mentioned before, these are 17 and 18 year old students who are applying for NCAA eligibility into sports. They shouldn't have to foot the bill for extra doctor's visits that the NCAA is requiring in order for the NCAA to determine the gender of a person. Or the gender identity of a person. They should not have to pay for hormone therapy. They shouldn't have to pay for anything that they themselves don't want or don't need. These NCAA student athletes who are doing this, they might not want to go see a psychiatrist in order to obtain a letter declaring that their gender identity is that of a woman. They know that. They don't need a psychiatrist to tell them that. And if that's what the NCAA is requiring, then they should lift the financial burden of having 17 and 18 year olds or those athletes coming from, you know, lower income families who can't afford to do things like send their children to psychiatrists and psychologists.
Okay. Well, those seem like some good recommendations with respect to this policy. I think that's very important. So thanks for sharing that. And thanks for taking the time out of your day to record this podcast. I think it's been a good discussion, and I think it's a discussion that needs to be happening. So thanks for coming on to talk about it. Is there anything else that you'd like to leave us with before we end?
You know, just that transgender student athletes want to play sports in the same way that non-transgender student athletes want to play sports. It's important for us to give everybody the equal opportunity to play NCAA sports and to remember why NCAA sports were founded back in the early 20th century. I just want to thank you, Peter, for giving me the opportunity to come on and share this. And I hope that we all become a little bit more aware of what is happening out there in the world of sports as it relates to transgender athletes.
Okay, well, great. Yeah, thanks for coming on. If people are interested, they can read more of your article. I'll link to it in the blog post. And yeah, thanks for coming on today.
Perfect. Thanks so much, Peter.
This has been an episode of the Sports Law Biz podcast. This podcast is available through the Sports Law Biz website or through iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and YouTube. Before wrapping things up, I'd like to thank some people. First of all, I'd like to thank my friend, Lieb Montoya, for designing the Sports Law Biz podcast logo, as well as the Sports Law Biz blog logo. His artistic ability certainly surpasses mine. If interested, you can check out more of Lieb's work on Instagram and Twitter. His handle is @LiebMontoya in both places. That's @LIBMontoya. Additionally, I'd like to thank the musical artist for providing this theme music that you're listening to right now. The artist is a band called The Losers. The album is entitled Young, Tough, Terrible. The track is Sports with an exclamation point. The label is Needle Drop Co. This music is available through a Creative Commons license of Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 Unported. This podcast was produced and recorded by myself, Peter Ott, and you can reach me at my personal Twitter handle, @PeterJOTT, through the Sports Law Biz Twitter handle, @SportsLawBiz, or through email at sportslawbizblog@gmail.com. Any feedback is greatly appreciated. If you are interested in contributing to either the Sports Law Biz blog or podcast, definitely reach out to me. I love to talk to people about these issues, and I know I can use all the help I can get. Finally, I'd like to thank you for listening to this podcast. Hopefully it was enjoyable. If so, please spread the word and let your friends and colleagues know about it. Leave a review on iTunes. Any way you can spread the news about this podcast would be greatly appreciated. That's our episode today. Tune in next time to learn more about the law and business of sports. I'm looking forward to discussing it with you on the Sports Law Biz podcast.